I want to finish up what I started last week on the subject of inequality, which is kind of the rage these days, especially among the liberal media. That's what they can't quit talking about. And one thing in particular that they've been talking about a lot is the alleged gender pay gap. Anybody heard of the gender pay gap? Right. The gender pay gap is this idea which that allegedly men make 23% more than women make for the same work, or women make 23% less than men make for the same work. And so how many of you, let me just show of hands, how many of you believe that to be the case before you hear any of the facts? Anybody believe that?
For the same work,
I would figure the place would pay the same thing. Yeah.
Well, and as unionized as everything is, unions, if you're in a unionized workplace, then the pay scale is set.
Yeah.
And so many places are unionized now that is, that's...
Right.
They can't do it.
And that would definitely be the case in a place like that. But even just in a regular market place, when you look at the data, we'll find out, and I'll just go through this briefly, that there really is no alleged gender pay gap at all for numerous reasons. So the figure is calculated by comparing the average salary of the average man with the salary of the average woman, basically full-time men and women. And they just look at the averages. Men on the average make X amount, women on the average make X amount working full-time, and men make 23% more than women. Therefore, it's just it's a misogynist, sexist society where they're paying men more than women for the same work. But it doesn't take into account virtually anything else, like hours worked, occupations, college majors, length of time in the workplace, or other factors. So when you count all that stuff in, then all of a sudden the gender pay gap supposedly or allegedly goes down to very minimally. For instance, men generally work in more lucrative occupations than women. I mean, that's going to explain a lot of it. A lot of times women work in more low-paying occupations that gives them schedule flexibility because women want that because they're taking care of kids and things like that. And that's worth more to them than the money in a lot of cases. Men choose professions like engineering or programming or manufacturing or things like that. And this is, I mean, these are general statements. This is not, you know, it's not to say that there aren't women doctors and that there aren't men ditch diggers. Obviously, that, you know, there are. But then women choose professions that focus on social interaction like psychology or sociology or early childhood development or secretarial work or things like that, which don't pay as well as a petroleum engineer, for instance, right? Petroleum engineering pays a lot of money. You're probably going to find about 1 in 100 women that are in petroleum engineering. It's just not a field that women like to go into. Women generally aren't the ice road truckers up in Alaska. They're not fishing for wild caught salmon up there and you know, the most dangerous profession in the world. They're not lumberjacks, right? They're not out there doing that kind of dirty, hard labor like that. And also the sciences, like the engineering and stuff like that. I mean, I'm an engineer, and we had very, very few women in those fields. Not that they can't do it, but they just don't want to. That's not their thing, right? And then men work way more hours, and they don't take off time for extended periods. And I don't remember what exactly the numbers are, but it's like something like men work on the average like 45 hours a week, where women work on the average of like 39 or 38 or something. So that makes a big difference in income as well. And of course, women take long sabbaticals for raising children. And that in and of itself, that's going to make the biggest difference. Because if you're a woman and you get into a career and you've been working there for a while, and then you take off several years to raise kids, and then you try to go back to work several years later, and your male counterparts have been working all those years and keeping up with everything, you're not going to make as much, right? I mean, that's a fact of life. So when you consider all these considerations and others, then the gender pay gap narrows to about 5 to 7%, you know, which is almost a rounding error. Now, if you think about this, if employers could really pay women 23% less for the same exact work, then they would, right? And they would fire all the men, and they'd hire only women, right? Because it's about the bottom line, right? I mean, that's a huge... You realize that Walmart's profit margins are probably like 1% or 2% or something like that. Grocery store profit margins are like razor thin. I mean, their profit margins are tiny. If they could make 23% more by simply laying off all the men and hiring women, they'd do it in a heartbeat, of course. That's just plain old economics. You know, it's funny, the same people that say that employers discriminate against women and pay them less than men are the same people that say corporations are greedy and they'll just pay people the absolute bare minimum that they can and they'll exploit every worker that they possibly can. Now, you can't have it both ways. You can't have corporations that are greedy that'll exploit workers and pay people the absolute bare bone minimum and then also have employers that just hate women so much that they'd be willing to pay 23% more to hire men. Right? It's not going to be both. You can't have both of those things. So you can take a look at this article here in the Huffington Compost. There, I abhor the Huffington Post, but this was actually a decent article by this woman, Christina Hoff Summers, on this issue. So you can take a look at that if you so choose. Okay, so the next thing I want to look at is the fact that government cannot create income equality, economic equality. And there's three reasons for that. The first reason is to use the government to create economic equality is immoral, right? So it's, I guess they could do this, but they shouldn't do this because it's just simply not right. The thing is, the government doesn't produce anything, right? So anything that the government gets, it steals from somebody else to give to another person. And we all know what Exodus 20 and verse 15 says, right? Thou shalt not steal, right? And that applies to governments or individuals or anybody. So whenever the government tries to redistribute wealth, that is immoral. That's wrong. They shouldn't do that. The Bible says that it's rich men, not governments, that are supposed to be, quote, ready to distribute, willing to communicate. Let's look at 1 Timothy 6 and verse 18. 1 Timothy 6, 18. Paul says in verse 17, charge them that are rich in this world that they be not high-minded nor trust in uncertain riches, but in the living God who giveth us richly all things to enjoy, that they do good, that they be rich in good works, ready to distribute, willing to communicate. Communicate means to give a portion or share to another person. So the rich are to be ready to distribute, right? But this is not written to governments. They're not to be ready to distribute, right? They're not supposed to be willing to communicate. If you are giving people charity out of somebody else's pocket, that is not charity, right? That's called theft. If I say, hey, my neighbor's fallen on hard times, I'm going to go rob my other neighbor and help him out, everybody would agree that's wrong. But it's equally wrong whenever elected officials do it in the name of philanthropy. The second reason, I just held up three fingers, the second reason that government cannot create economic equality is because they are inefficient, right? They don't really have the means to do so, even if they wanted to. You see, if you take resources away from producers and you give them to consumers, you're going to create a society of less producers and more consumers, right? This is not rocket science, right? So if you take, that's what they do. Whenever they take from the rich, these are the producers. These are the people that produce things and create jobs, right? When you take from producers and give to consumers, you're going to have less producers and more consumers. What's going to happen in a society where you have less and less producers and more consumers, right? It's the same thing that's going to happen to an animal that has a whole bunch of leeches inside of it. He's the producer, they're the consumer, and when you get less and less of him and more consumers, he's going to be consumed, right? There's going to be nothing left. And this is what happens to socialist societies. This would mean a society with less material wealth. And in this system, both the rich and the poor would only get poorer, right? When you start taking things from the rich, not only does it hurt them, but eventually it hurts the whole society, because they're not going to be out there producing things anymore. The third reason why the government cannot create economic equality is because it's impossible. Even if it were possible to achieve economic equality, it wouldn't last. If you think about it, let's just say that they redistribute everything and they get everybody completely equal. That would last until the first transaction was made, and then all of a sudden somebody's not equal anymore. Because somebody made a transaction that now somebody has something more than somebody else does. So it's a goal that is unattainable. The government would never reach its goal. But you know what? That's the way they want it. The government loves unattainable goals. Because if you have attainable goals, you can only do it until you meet the goal, and then you have to stop doing it, right? And that doesn't work for, you know, those types in society. They want to continually have more and more power. That's why they start things called, like, the war on terrorism. That's an unattainable goal. You can't win a war on terrorism. It's a war against an idea. That's impossible. You can never, it's unwinnable. The war on poverty, right? You can't win that war. The war on drugs, you can't win that war. They've been trying it since the 70s. Drugs are a bad thing, but the war on drugs, you know, doesn't work. But they love this kind of stuff because they just, the more that they fail, the more and more and more money that they get thrown at them. It's so perverse because in the private sector, if you fail at something, you go out of business. In the government sector, if you fail at something, you get more business, right? Think about it.
You need more money to correct it.
You need more money, bigger budgets. That's why we couldn't make it work. We didn't have enough money. In the private sector, if you have a charitable organization like a food shelf and you're trying to feed the poor, the idea is to get less and less people on the dole. The idea is to help out people, get them on their feet so that they're not coming to the food shelf. The government food shelf, the idea for that is to get more and more people coming in, right? Totally opposite incentives. Contrary to their stated aims, the government loves inequality because it gives them an excuse to grab more and more power and control of the population. And talk about an unattainable goal. Equality among people. Financial equality is never going to be reached. Therefore, they'll always have a purpose for existing. I'm going to read you a little quote here. This is from a guy named Vladimir Bukovsky. He wrote a book, either a book or an article, called To Build a Castle. This guy was a Soviet dissident back in the days of the Soviet Union from the 50s until the 70s. He spent 12 years in Soviet prison camps, labor camps, and psychiatric hospitals. Because if you opposed the regime, you must be crazy, and they put you in a psych ward or something. And this is what this guy had to say, and this just fits so well in with the topic of equality or inequality. I wanted to read it to you. He said, "This dream of absolute universal equality is amazing, terrifying, and inhuman. And the moment it captures people's minds, the result is mountains of corpses and rivers of blood, accompanied by attempts to straighten the stooped and shorten the tall. I remember that one part of the psychiatric examination was a test for idiocy. The patient was given the following problem to solve. Imagine a train crash. It is well known that the part of the train that suffers the most damage in such crashes is the carriage at the rear. How can you prevent that damage from taking place? The idiot's usual reply is expected to be, uncouple the last carriage. That strikes us as amusing, but just think, are the theory and practice of socialism much better? Society, say the socialists, contains both the rich and the poor. The rich are getting richer and the poor poorer. What is to be done? Uncouple the last carriage, liquidate the rich, take away their wealth and distribute it among the poor, and they start to uncouple the carriages. But there is always one carriage at the back. There are always richer and poorer. For societies like a magnet, there are always two poles. But does this discourage a true socialist? The main thing is to realize his dream, so the richest section of society is liquidated first. And everyone rejoices because everyone gains from the share out. But the spoils are soon spent, and people start to notice inequality again. Again, there are rich and poor. So they uncouple the next carriage, and then the next, without end, because absolute equality has still not been achieved. Before you know it, the peasant who has two cows and a horse turns out to be in the last carriage and is pronounced a kulak and deported. Is it really surprising that whenever you get striving for equality and fraternity, the guillotine appears on the scene? It is difficult for man to resist this dream and this noble impulse, particularly for men who are impetuous and sincere. They are the first to start chopping heads off and eventually to have their own chopped off." And that's a pretty good description of communism in the Soviet Union. And the French Revolution as well, that type of thing happened. And pretty much in all communist revolutions, that's what happens. Eat the rich, ship them off, get rid of them, put them in labor camps or something, and then they just keep going after more and more people and until nobody's safe. So on this topic of equality, you know, most people just think about their own country. We just think about the U.S. But you realize the U.S., there's only 330 million people here, and there's another 7 billion people out there in the world. So we're like 5% of the world population. So if people are really concerned about equality, then you wouldn't just simply stop at the U.S. and just make everybody in the U.S. equal, because we're all human beings, right? You want to make the whole world equal, right? Well, this is where nobody wants to go, or at least no American wants to go. Because if all people should be economically equal, then the wealth of wealthy Americans should be distributed to the poorest of the world, right? And that's not just the rich fat cat billionaires. That's you and I and everybody else, because let's face it, we, any one of us, are way more wealthy than the vast majority of the people on this planet, way more wealthy. So this means that the minuscule wealth of the poor in America would have to be confiscated and given to those who are far poorer in places like Africa or Asia or other places. And guess what this would require to implement? A world government, right? Isn't that what they want? I mean, that's, you know, that, a lot of these things, equality requires a world government. Global warming stuff, the climate change requires a global government, because you have to control all the carbon output of all the nations of the world and manage all this and create a carbon tax across the world. So a lot of these noble causes to save humanity and to help everybody out is nothing more than a ploy for world government. They won't admit that, most of them, but that's what it comes down to. Now, some people think, well, maybe just robbing the rich is not a good idea, but if we could just educate people, then that will eliminate inequality, because if everybody gets a good education, then everybody's going to be wise and smart and prosperous, right? But, you know, the average education cost in the U.S. is $11,392 per year, right? You could just about, you could go to a college for that, right? And, well, I think you still could. I mean, they're getting more expensive all the time, but that's the average cost. But some states are even higher. New Jersey's over 18,000, Connecticut 18,000, Washington D.C. 19,000, Alaska 20,000, New York $21,000. You could go, at least back when I was going to college, you could probably go to a private university for that kind of money. And this is what you're paying K through 12, 13 years of education. I mean, think about how much money that is. That's like $260,000 for an education, so-called education. These days, I would say if 260 grand poured into our youth is not creating equality now, chances are another 260 is probably not going to make much of a difference, I would think. Especially given the fact that if you gave me, oh, I don't know, $100 maybe, enough for a chalkboard and some chalk, you could probably educate kids with anything they could ever possibly need to know. It doesn't take $260,000. And you have to pay a teacher salary, I suppose, but you know, but other than that, maybe a little building for them to meet in or something. But you could do it for less than $260 a student, I think. I'm pretty sure. And the fact is that even if you do, in part, you know, try to make everybody wise with education, the fact is that a lot of people just don't want to be educated, and it's not, no price is going to educate them. You look in Proverbs 17 and verse 16. Proverbs 17, 16. It says, wherefore is there a price in the hand of a fool to get wisdom, seeing he hath no heart to it? And I think of a lot of kids going to college where their parents send them, or somebody sends them with a check in their hand, whether it's a Pell Grant or whatever, and they want them to get wisdom, and they're just going to pay the money to get it, but they don't have a heart to it. And they drink it away, they party it away. It's just a waste of time. And I think, you know, I'm driving a bus now, and it gives me a different perspective on things. And I think, you know, it's no wonder that a lot of these kids are disgruntled and they're troublemakers, because you take these kids, especially in their adolescence, and they don't care about the vast majority of stuff they're learning. They can reason and say, you know what, I'm never going to use this again. This is pretty well useless information to me. I'm just in a babysitting place for 7 hours, and I could be out doing something, learning something that I want to learn, or working, or doing something that would be of value to me. And so you make them stay there in this place for 7 hours a day, and just against their will, basically. And it's no wonder that they have bad attitudes, and because it's not a, it's not really a natural environment at all. Because this is, we think of it as natural because that's what we all did. We all went to school when we were young. But you know, a couple hundred years ago, people were homeschooled. You know, or it was maybe like a little one room schoolhouse setting or something like that, and just a little community. And it wasn't the school system that we have today. And it wasn't for 13 years. You might go for what, 6 years, 8 years, or something. And then by the time you hit adolescence, you went out and you learned to do something, you know, from your dad or from, you know, a local businessman or whatever. You went out and started working. And if you wanted specialized education to be a lawyer or be a doctor or something, then you continued on. But nowadays, it's just no wonder that, that you have so much trouble with kids in school, because why wouldn't they rebel? Because, you know, it's like you're sticking them in a cage, and they don't want to be in a cage, right? They want to go do something. Now, I think you... everybody needs to learn how to read and write and do math. I mean, there's some education that, that you should make kids do, I think, because they don't have enough sense to realize that they do need some things. But 13 years of it, I'm not sure about that for the average kid anyway. But anyway, that's another talk. So let's look at what is the root cause of this desire for equality. And as far as I can tell, it's two things. It's greed, which is fueled by envy. That's really what it comes down to when people want equality, and especially people that just hate the rich, you know, that the one percenters, you know, they ought to pay. They ought to pay their fair share. What is their fair share? I mean, if 50% of their income is not their fair share, what exactly is their fair share, right? I mean, the 1% pays like 90% of the taxes or something. I mean, they pay the vast majority of the taxes. You know, it's like people talk about these tax cuts and they get upset about it because this is just a, you know, a handout to the rich. It's not a handout if you reduce somebody's taxes. If you're robbing them less than you were before, that's not a handout, right? You're just taking less from them than you were, right? So, I mean, this kind of stuff drives me crazy. But it's just greed. Greed is inordinate or insatiable longing, especially for wealth. Avaricious or covetous desire. And the thing is with greedy people is they will trouble everybody. They'll trouble their own house, the Bible says. Proverbs 17 and verse 16. And especially when you get greedy people in the halls of government where they can make public policy, that's a really dangerous thing. When you have people that just have a hatred for other successful people and for people that have more than other people, that's a recipe for disaster whenever you can allow people like that to make laws. Proverbs 17 and verse 16. Oh, I was looking at, there you go. I was going to say, oh, that's really close to the verse I just read. Proverbs 15:27. He that is greedy of gain troubleth his own house, but he that hateth gifts shall live. Think about it. The house of representatives. He that's greedy of gain troubleth his own house, but he that hateth gifts shall live. And gifts, in the Bible anyway, in most cases, and in this definitely in this case, is referring to a bribe, right? And that's how Washington, D.C. works, with gifts, quote-unquote. Lobbyists come in and give gifts, right? Junkets, plane, you know, or vacations to some nice place to be wined and dined, and you ever wonder why guys get out of Congress and then they end up being an advisor on some board and some big corporation somewhere, and they probably have absolutely no skills for that at all? That's what happens. They get in there, they make the votes for the people that gave them all the campaign donations, and then when they get out, they're given a nice job somewhere at some big company. You know, the military-industrial complex is typical of that, and banks and other places like that. That's how it works. Lazy people are often greedy. They want what others have that they're too lazy to work for. Proverbs 21, 25 through 26. Proverbs 21, 25 through 26. Says, the desire of the slothful killeth him, for his hands refuse to labor. He coveteth greedily all the day long, but the righteous giveth and spareth not. There you got the difference between the righteous man and the wicked, the diligent man and the slothful. They both desire things, right? The slothful, he desires, But his desire kills him because he's just too lazy to work for it. But the righteous, on the other hand, he's generous and he gives. He works diligently and produces something, and then he's generous with it. Where the others out there that just want to rob the diligent, they're not generous, only with other people's money. Right? It's not generosity when it's with other people's money. Now, envy is really the heart of this lust for equality. Envy is malignant or hostile feeling, ill will, malice, enmity. It is the feeling of mortification and ill will occasioned by the contemplation of superior advantages possessed by another. That's what it really comes down to. A lot of people out there just simply hate people that are better than they are, or that have things that they don't have, or were blessed with advantages that they didn't have. They just can't stand to see somebody else successful. And that's what a lot of these, and you'll see this more and more with these protests. And part of it is, I think, legitimately, there's legitimate anger out there, because there are people that do get rich because of cronyism. They do get rich because they're sucking on the government teat, basically. And they get the big, their corporations get the big contracts, and because their lobbyists go in there and do that kind of stuff. And that's wrong. And when you have, you know, a lot of these guys, these fat cats, when, like, for instance, when the Federal Reserve increased the money supply from 2008 for several years after that, and you can just look at the stock market chart and look at the money supply chart, and it's like they're one chart. The more money gets pumped in, it just goes into the stock market. And who makes all those gains? The big fat cats, right? So they end up getting a lot richer because of all the inflation that's created by the government, whereas the average Joe on the street, none of that really ends up trickling down to him. So I can understand their anger in some ways, but they don't make a difference between people that got it with ill-gotten gains and people that got it the good old-fashioned way of just ingenuity and entrepreneurship and hard work. They just hate everybody that is, you know, more prosperous than they are. And that's why envy is one of the most vicious sins. Proverbs 27 and verse 4. And the problem is, whenever you do see, whenever inequality continues to grow, and especially if it continues to grow because of corruption and things like that, and that's what happens a lot of times in like third world countries, where you'll have the people at the top, the leaders of the country, are just ridiculously wealthy because they're taking everything, and by fraud and corruption, and the people at the bottom have absolutely nothing. That's whenever revolutions happen. That's whenever blood starts running in the streets and things like that. And that's a danger whenever you start going down the path of socialism. Like, things like that can happen. And but if you stick with just a free market, then you may have rich people, but you're not going to have everybody else that's just totally dirt poor with nothing. They might not be as rich, but they're going to be more prosperous, and you're going to have a functioning society. Anyway, okay, Proverbs 27 and verse 4. It says, wrath is cruel and anger is outrageous, but who is able to stand before envy? A lot of times I think if you asked people, if you said, okay, we got three things, wrath, anger, and envy, which are the worst? I bet you most people would say wrath and anger. Because when you think of an envious person, you just kind of think of it, it's just inside, right? It's a heart thing. He's probably not really hurting anybody. He's just kind of bitter inside. But the Bible says that envy is worse than wrath and anger. Wrath's cruel, anger's outrageous, but who is able to stand before envy? The rhetorical question is, envy's worse, right? Because envy is not just an outward appearance of anger. Envy's that inward feeling of ill will, malice, and enmity. Like, that just absolute hatred of somebody. And boy, if you could kill them, you would. All right? You got enough sense to keep your anger in, but boy, that envy just will burn in there, and it will end up really causing some major damage if it's allowed to fester. In fact, it was the reason why the Son of God was murdered in Mark 15 and verse 10. Mark 15 and verse 10. This is speaking of Pilate. For he knew that the chief priest had delivered him, that is Jesus Christ, for envy. He knew what it was all about. They hated him because he was righteous. They tried to kill him. They tried to he said, which of you convinceth me of sin? Which of you can convict me of sin? They set up false witnesses because they didn't have anything legit on him. He was such a good man, and they hated him so bad because he called out their hypocrisy and their iniquity, but there was just nothing they could get him with. And their envy just ate them up until they finally orchestrated his murder. Same thing happened to Joseph, Acts 7 and verse 9. Joseph's brethren, they, because of envy, they sold their own brother into slavery, into Egypt. Acts 7 and verse 9. This is why the Bible says, who can stand before envy? Acts 7 and verse 9. And the patriarchs, moved with envy, sold Joseph into Egypt, but God was with him. Envy will ruin a person. Proverbs 14 and verse 30. This is one of those sins where if you find yourself succumbing to it, or you find yourself tempted with it, you want to rebuke yourself and get rid of that feeling. If you ever feel ill will at somebody else because of something that they have, and it's easy to let that creep in, you want to get rid of that because it will end up being your demise. Proverbs 14 and verse 30. It says, a sound heart is the life of the flesh, but envy the rottenness of the bones. It's funny, you have ill will and hatred towards somebody else, but who ends up being harmed by your envy? You. It's the rottenness of the bones. It destroys your health. It destroys your mental and spiritual well-being. It doesn't hurt the guy that you hate. It causes strife, including social strife. And I think we're seeing a lot of that now. We're seeing people that, you know, why do you think Bernie Sanders' campaign was so popular? What was this campaign about? Just give everybody free everything, free education, socialism, right? You know, soak the rich, tax the rich. And, I mean, that's envy that's going to cause strife. And it's not good. I don't like the direction that things are heading in this country at all. James 3 and verse 16. It says, for where envying and strife is, there is confusion and every evil work. Now, this is true in a church, but it's true in a nation too. Confusion and every evil work. And that's really what I would say Bernie Sanders' whole campaign is based on, is envy, really. When you're promising people that we're just going to tax these fat cats and provide you with free education and free, I don't know, whatever, $15 an hour minimum wage, and everything he's promising people, that's a recipe for strife. And greed breeds envy. James 4 and verse 5. It says, do you think that the scripture saith in vain, the spirit that dwelleth in us lusteth to envy? Lust is greed. It ends in envy. So when you have greed, you're going to end up having envy. And as Christians, we should not be envious of anyone, especially the wicked. And we talked about that in Psalm 37 in that Bible study series. But if you look in Romans 13 and verse 13, Romans 13:13 says, let us walk honestly as in the day, not in rioting or drunkenness, not in chambering or wantonness, not in strife and envying. Strife and envying are lumped right in there with drunkenness and chambering and wantonness, which is fornication. I mean, those are some serious sins, and strife and envy is lumped right in there with them. In Galatians 5 and verse 26. Galatians 5:26. Let us not be desirous of vainglory, provoking one another, envying one another. We shouldn't envy the wicked, but we especially shouldn't envy each other. Shouldn't envy another one of our brothers or sisters in Christ whenever they have, you know, something that we don't have. And that's the case with all of us. Every one of us has something that the other one doesn't have. and would probably like to have if we could, but we never want to fall into that trap of envy. And then those that clamor for inequality or for equality are not content, right? They're not content with what they have. Content is having one's desires bounded by what one has, though that may be less than one could have wished, not disturbed by the desire of anything more or of anything different, satisfied so as not to repine, easy though not highly pleased. I don't think that was like one of Bernie Sanders' campaign slogans, right? That's not exactly what the average socialist is known for, as contentment. The Bible teaches in Hebrews 13 and verse 5 that we should be content with such things as we have. And if you want more, then work for it, right? There you go. That's that's what you got to do. Hebrews 13 and verse 5. Let your conversation, that is your manner of life, be without covetousness, and be content with such things as ye have. For he hath said, I will never leave thee nor forsake thee. You see, you got covetousness and contentment, which are the opposite. And covetousness is what I was talking about earlier. Greed, right? What is the solution to greed? It is contentment, right? If people were content with what they had, they wouldn't care that there are CEOs out there making $23 million a year. What does it matter, right? If you're content with what you have, if some other dude's making $20 million a year, what's it matter? There's probably a reason he's making $20 million a year. Corporations aren't stupid, right? I mean, if you're the CEO of Walmart, and you're making decisions that are going to affect a multi-billion dollar corporation, which hires millions of people. I mean, $20 million of compensation to make decisions for a corporation like that and decide the future of where it's going to head and what it's going to do. I mean, you ain't going to have the janitor getting up there and making those kind of decisions. I mean, there's a reason why those dudes are paid $20 million. And if they weren't worth it, I don't think the corporation would be paying them for it. I mean, I don't know, that's the way that I look at it anyway. Inequality is a fact of life, and it's just something we're going to have to learn to live with. I mean, that's just what it comes down to. What someone else has should be no bearing on our contentment. What's it matter? Like I said last week, what's it matter if there are billionaires that have multi-million dollar homes or yachts or cars or whatever? I mean, that doesn't change my life one bit. You think about it. If I didn't know that there was a billionaire that had a yacht, would it affect me at all? No, I don't know it, right? Now, if I find out about it, should it affect me at all? It didn't make a bit of difference in my life before I knew about it, so if I know about it, what's it going to matter, right? I mean, unless I find out that he's been robbing me to get it or something, you know, but other than that, what's it matter? I don't have a problem. Like, I see these YouTube videos sometimes, and I don't watch this kind of stuff very often because it's probably a waste of time. But once in a while, you have these videos that are about like the uber wealthy and their big yachts or their homes or their cars. And I like watching that kind of stuff from time to time and just seeing that and thinking, wow, that's incredible. And I'm not envious of that. I mean, I see them with their yachts and I'm thinking, man, that is just amazing. It doesn't bother me. You know, I wish they'd take me for a ride on it. But, you know, I mean, that doesn't cause me any trouble at all. Someone else's excessive riches cannot affect your quality of life unless you let it affect you through envy. That's the only way that it can affect you at all. I think people look at the economy out there as like there's a set amount of stuff, and if some rich guy gets a bunch of it, then that's less for the rest of us. But that's not how the economy works, right? Because, I mean, the economy started out with basically nothing, just raw materials, a bunch of stuff in the dirt, basically. If you think about it, everything that we see, just go to a city and look around, everything at one time was in the ground, right? All those buildings, all those cars, all the computers, everything that you see was at one time in the dirt. And somebody dug it up, mined it, refined it, engineered it, designed it, and made a bunch of stuff. So it's not like there's a set amount of stuff, and if some rich dude gets a bunch of it, that's less for me to get. No, there's practically an infinite amount of possibilities of stuff out there. And if some rich guy goes out there and works really hard and produces a great company producing a bunch of stuff, well, guess what? He's made the world more wealthy, like Steve Jobs or something. Now, whether you think smartphones are a good thing in the long run or not for society, I think it's debatable. They're nice, but I think it's messing a lot of us up, myself included, all of us. But assuming, let's just assume for the sake of the argument, that those were good things that have improved the quality of life of people, and they have to an extent. Well, think about what a benefactor of mankind Steve Jobs was. He put smartphones into the hands of all kinds of people, which the richest kings in Europe could have never even dreamed of and had if they had all the gold in the world. They could have never had one because some dude didn't dig all that stuff up and make it into an iPhone or whatever. So, to hate the rich that earn their money like that is to really hate the people that have benefited, all of us with all kinds of things that we take for granted every day. Now, I said this the other day, and I'm just going to elaborate a little bit on it. I'd say that economic inequality is actually a good thing. And I realize that's a heretical statement for a lot of people to hear. But I'd say, like I said before, it's good as long as it's caused by the free market, by just simply free market transactions, people going out there, mixing their labor with raw materials, and saving and investing and being entrepreneurial, and creating things that people value that they would trade their money for. As long as you're doing it that way, that's a great thing. As long as you're not doing it by fraud or theft or cronyism, which would be corporations getting contracts from government through bribes or lobbying. As long as it's done honestly and somebody gets rich doing that, I don't see any problem with it. In fact, I think it's a good thing. A free market economy will facilitate some people becoming wealthy because of their entrepreneurship, diligence, and foresight. There's just some people out there that just have what it takes. And, I think Conrad said that 15% of the people, 15% of the people, no, 5% of the people make things happen, 15% of the people help things to happen, and 80% of the people don't know what's happening. And that's probably about the case, when you really think about it. In the world, that's probably about what happens. So anyway, where was I going with that? Oh, some people just have what it takes. I mean, they're just business minded. They can see a need that needs fulfilled and figure out a way to do it and a way to market it and they're just good at that kind of thing. And it's just amazing, that people can do that out there. And people can, engineers and scientists can come up with all kinds of amazing things, and that makes us all more wealthy. But it's going to make them very wealthy. But that's fine. That's a good thing. Because what wealthy people do then is they invest their money in businesses and capital equipment, and that ends up employing the non-entrepreneurs like most of us, right? And it ends up making our labor exponentially more productive. Because if you think about it, if you went to do probably most any job with your own two bare hands, you're not going to be able to do very much, right? You're going to be at subsistence level. Like if you just took your own two bare hands, you might be able to keep yourself alive. Maybe. If you were lucky. I mean, you think about it. Just with your two hands. I mean, no equipment at all. It'd be pretty darn hard. I mean, no guns, no bows, no nothing, right? I mean, it'd be pretty darn hard to keep yourself alive until you've got some equipment to work with. And that's what wealthy people do, is they invest in businesses and equipment. And then all of a sudden, the guy that could only pick up 40 pounds and put it on a shelf with his arms can pick up 40,000 pounds with a forklift and wheel it around all over the place and do work that he could have never done without the capitalist that invested in the capital equipment that made that man more productive, you see. So that's why I say inequality is a good thing, because the rich don't spend a lot of their money, right? They invest more of their money, most of their money. Now, maybe they do it just because of their own greed and they want to get richer. But that's okay, because when they do that, they end up making all of us more wealthy and more productive because of that. If they just blew all their money on frivolous living, then we'd all be worse off. So this increases everyone's productivity and consequently their wages, making everyone more wealthy than they would have been otherwise. I would say that inequality is not really the issue. The issue is people's quality of life and their standard of living. So if in a capitalist society, the rich get richer, but the poor get richer too, just at a not as much, not at the same level or not at the same rate. But if the poor are getting richer, then I don't see it as a problem. The disparity of the wealth between the rich and the poor is not nearly as important as whether or not the standard of living of the poor is increasing. That's what I'm saying. The standard of living of the poor has increased dramatically over the last 200 years. The poor today enjoy luxuries that the rich could have only dreamed of 200, 300 years ago. Let me just give you some examples of what the poor, quote unquote, here's what the poor, at least of this country, enjoy that the Habsburgs of Europe, the richest kings the world has ever known, King Solomon, would not have had one single one of these things. None of them. And this is what the poor enjoy. Electricity in their homes. You realize that? The richest people the world's ever known 300 years ago never experienced it. They'd be sitting in the dark right now with some candles. No electricity. No refrigerator. No anything. I mean, you think about no running water. I mean, just think about all this stuff. No hot water. You know, unless you're going to build a fire and heat it up. But, you know, no. I mean, just think about that. Listening to recorded music at any time. Just think about that. You realize that 300 years ago, if you wanted to hear music, you made it. Or you hired somebody to play for you. You know, people just take it for granted. You pop in your earbuds or you turn on the radio and you listen to music. That never happened for like 6,000 years almost of world history. If you wanted to hear music, you played it or you hired somebody to come in and play for you. Now, how many people had enough money to hire an orchestra to come in and play for them? Nobody, right? How many people could afford an instrument in those days? Probably not too many. I doubt it, right? But we just have that at our fingertips. The poor, the poorest of the poor, you can listen to radio for free. I don't care if you're a homeless bum. You can listen to radio for free, right? Think about that. Owning an automobile. King Solomon was riding in a horse and carriage, you know. The richest kings of Europe were riding in a four-horse carriage. The poor today have cars that can take them 60 miles an hour down the highway with heating and air conditioning. The poor. Think about that. Traveling by air? I mean, somebody of relatively basic means can travel to the other side of the world in less than 24 hours today. Think about that. Over 100 years ago, nobody could do that. Air conditioning in your home. Television. I don't know if that's a good thing, but anyway, I mean, you know, the richest of the rich would have had nothing like that. Access to the internet. Having a telephone, a cell phone, a computer, a microwave, antibiotics. And you could go on and on and on. Things that the richest of the rich could have only dreamed about, probably couldn't even dream about. And now, pretty much the poorest of the poor have or could have almost any of those things. Just think about that. What is that the result of? Government redistribution? No. It's the result of the free market. It's the result of, you know, of people freely interacting and building stuff. Because for a long time in this country, the government just got out of the way and just let people do what they wanted to do. And they built up all this stuff that we have. And there was no dude with a bullhorn shouting at them, telling everybody what to do and what parts to make and what to produce. And people just did it. It's called the invisible hand. Just amazing. This is one thing that if I have children, that I want to instill into them, like the wonder of the market. You know, just of how amazing it is when you go, like when you go to the grocery store and you just look at it and you just think, this is a miracle. This is an absolute miracle. I have at my fingertips almost anything I could possibly want to eat from all over the world. And I don't even know any of these people that put it all in here. And they didn't even know I was going to show up today. But I showed up and it's all here. It's a miracle. It's an absolute miracle. And the government, I mean, think about it. One of the most important things in the world, and that is feeding us food, the governments, they don't have any. They don't manage that at all, right? That's taken care of just on the market. And somehow we manage to keep us all alive, you know, without some dude on a bullhorn telling us what to do. So the gap between the standard of living of the rich and the poor has narrowed greatly over the last few centuries. Just one example. A few hundred years ago, the rich rode in a four-horse carriage while the poor walked, right? That's the difference between the rich and poor, right? That was, kind of a big difference. But still, I mean, okay, so he's enjoying leisure, traveling at 8 miles an hour. You're kind of sweating at 3 miles an hour. Not that big of a difference, right? But I mean, it's a big difference, right? Now the rich drive a fancy car and the poor drive a clunker. But guess what? The rich used to drive a four-horse carriage and the poor walked. Now the poor is in the same type of vehicle, just not as nice of a one. And they're both traveling down the highway at the same speed with the same amount of effort. Think about that. It's a huge improvement, the standard of living of the poor compared to the rich. And even if the rich are getting richer at a faster rate, the poor are still getting richer. So what are people complaining about? Poor are still getting richer. And more people are being lifted out of poverty worldwide, globally. Mm-hmm. It's exponential rates, you know, over the last, just even the last 20 or 30 years. Okay, now lastly, I just want to cover, I really haven't gotten to a lot of Bible. I want to cover, how would you help the poor biblically? How would you alleviate inequality biblically? You're never going to eliminate it, that's for sure. We talked about that last week. But here's how we can help them biblically. The first thing to do is work ourselves to have money to give to those that are in need. That's one of the reasons why we should work. Ephesians 4 and verse 28. Ephesians 4 and verse 28. So we shouldn't just work for ourselves. We should be working so that we have the ability to help out others that are in need. That's part of our duty as Christians and just as people, to help out others that are in need. Ephesians 4 and verse 28. Let him that stole steal no more, but rather let him labor, working with his hands, the thing which is good, that he may have to give to him that needeth. You see, there's the solution to the thief. Work. And don't just work so that you don't have to steal. Work so that you can help out other people that need it. That's part of the reason for working. Helping people financially should be limited to supplying their needs, though, not their lusts. Let's look at Romans 12 and verse 13. This is why the Bible way is going to work out much better than the government way, because the government way isn't going to work, because they just kind of give out indiscriminately to people, and they're not really helping very many people at all. Romans 12 and verse 13 says, that's 11, 13. Romans 12, 13. Distributing to the necessity of saints, given to hospitality. So we should be distributing, but it's to the necessity of saints, not to the lusts, not to the just the desires of people, but whenever somebody actually needs something. And the Bible's qualifications for needs are the basic needs of the body, like food and clothing and shelter. James 2, 15 through 16. It says, if a brother or sister be naked and destitute of daily food, and one of you say unto them, depart in peace, be ye warmed and filled, notwithstanding ye give them not those things which are needful to the body, what doth it profit? You see how the Bible defines things that are needful to the body as naked and destitute of daily food. So food and clothing, and you could say shelter as well. You could prove that because Jesus said that you took me in Matthew 25, and I was a stranger and you took me in. So he says, I was thirsty, you gave me drink, a stranger, you took me in, naked, you clothed me. So you see, taking somebody in, if they need a place to stay out of the elements, that's a basic human need as well. So those things are what we are under obligation to help people. When you find somebody that's in that kind of need, then we are definitely under obligation to help them. And if we don't, the love of God is not in us. 1 John 3 and verse 17.
Church member or not.
Church member or not.
As it is our occasion to help.
Yep. Just like the Good Samaritan, right? Jesus says, who's his neighbor? And the Samaritan was not the guy's physical neighbor, right? It was a Levite, I believe. That fell among thieves, And it wasn't a Samaritan anyway. And the Samaritan comes along and just finds the guy laying there half dead, and he helped him out. But he wasn't, you know, sitting there watching cable television and seeing about some poor guy over on the other side of the planet and decided to send him a check. That's not what the Good Samaritan was doing. It was somebody in his sphere, right in front of him, basically, and the guy needed help, and that's whenever we need to help him. 1 John 3 and verse 17 says, "But whoso hath this world's good, and seeth his brother have need, and shutteth up his bowels of compassion from him, how dwelleth the love of God in him?" So I would definitely question somebody's spirituality if you could walk by somebody whom you knew in your heart that this man is in genuine need, and you just walk by and say, "Nah, I'm not helping him out." Now, if you're walking by the bum that's got the cup out along the side of the street, that's different because you don't, I mean, is he really in need? Who knows? Probably not, honestly. And if he is in need, what the heck are you sitting along the side of the road for, an able-bodied man with a cup out? Go get a job, especially today. I mean, there aren't that many great jobs, I don't think, out there, but there are pretty much jobs out there for anybody that can fog a mirror. I mean, everybody's hiring right now. I don't know how long that's going to continue, but right now, nobody has an excuse for not having a job. You know, even it may not be a great job, but it's, you know, it's better than nothing. So anyway. So when brethren in the church are in need, and I emphasize this, due to no fault of their own, those that have been blessed with abundance should supply for their need. Now, you will have people, even church members, you know, we're not exempted from stupidity. There are church members that will do dumb things and get themselves into trouble, and they might not, maybe they shouldn't be helped, because maybe the best thing to do to help them is to not help them, right? Because then that teaches them a lesson. Now, if they're starving, that's a different story. But if they're just hurting, like stinging from some dumb decision that they made, and maybe the inclination is, oh, maybe I should just help him out. Maybe you shouldn't. It just depends, because helping him out will not help him to learn the lesson that he needs to learn, right? So those are gray areas, and you gotta make your own decision in those ones. But 2 Corinthians 8. 13 through 15. 2 Corinthians 8, 13 through 15. Paul says, "For I mean not that other men be eased and ye burdened," talking to these Corinthians who were willingly helping out the poor saints in Jerusalem he was taking up this collection for. He says, "But by inequality," there's the word we've been looking at, "that now at this time your abundance may be a supply for their want," that's the poor folks in Jerusalem, "that their abundance also may be a supply for your want, that there may be equality. As it is written, he that had gathered much had nothing over, and he that had gathered little had no lack." He's talking about the manna back in the wilderness. So this is the Bible's idea of equality. So whenever you had like the poor saints in Jerusalem and they had been hit with a terrible dearth, with a famine in the land, no fault of their own, they're just hit with really hard times. And Paul says there should be inequality. You people here are blessed with abundance. You ought to be helping them. And someday it's going to be the other way around. They're going to have abundance. They're going to help you. Right? That's the Bible's idea of inequality. But it's a voluntary thing. It's not, you know, nobody's under compulsion and forced to, you know, have their something taken from them and given to somebody else. Like I quoted there in 1 Timothy 6, 17 and 18, rich men should be willing to give, ready to distribute, willing to communicate. But it should be done voluntarily, not by compulsion. Like I said, when the government gives to the poor, they do so by forcing one person to hand over their wealth to another. And when the government does this, when they provide for those in need, they do it very inefficiently. The other problem with government aid is that it reduces the incentive for individuals to help the poor because they assume that they've already done so through their taxes. Mm-hmm. We probably all thought that, you know, like, you know what? I get taxed so much and the government gives money to the poor, or they help out, you know, disaster victims or whatever, that, you know, somebody else will take care of them. I mean, that's what we think a lot of times, right? Yeah, somebody else will take care of them because the government's there. And if the government wasn't there, then maybe we would think, you know what? There is nobody else to take care of them. I'll help, right? So it is when the government does it, it's a disincentive for other people to help out. And if other people, if individuals were helping out, they would be much more cautious to make sure that that money went to somebody that actually needs it, not to some organization that's going to take 75% of it for the managers of it and give the other 25% to the charity case. The best thing the government can do to help the poor is to not help them and instead let society help them. So you never want to mix up your terms. Don't ever mix up society with the government, right? The government is not society. The government is a small little part of society that happens to pillage the rest of us, right? They're not society. They're not the country. The country and the government are not the same thing. The government is just a little section of the country that you know, screws the rest of us. But society should be taking care of these things. If the government just ceased taxing and regulating businesses, it would enable them to hire more people and increase wages. And that would help the poor more than anything else, right? Give them a job, right? There, you've permanently fed the poor by giving them a job, right? The government can do that by just simply stop taxing as much and stop regulating. The government can also help the poor by not running up deficits and printing money, which devalues the money and increases the cost of everything. You want to help the poor? Quit screwing with the money. You know, if we were under the gold standard, you know all you'd have to do to save for retirement? Just take your little gold coins and put them under your mattress. And every year, those little gold coins become a little bit more valuable. Because the amount of stuff in the economy keeps growing at a faster rate than those little gold coins do. Right? You mine out gold, maybe you increase the gold supply by 2 or 3% per year. Okay, there's only so much gold out there, and the more you mine it, the harder it gets. So, you know, you're never going to be mining out, you know, doubling the gold supply every year. It's just not going to happen, right? So you increase the gold supply just a little bit every year, but the stuff that the economy produces is way more than the amount of gold that's produced every year. So if you have more stuff and roughly the same amount of gold, that means that gold will buy more of that stuff, right? The prices of that stuff is going to come down, right? That money is going to become more valuable. But on the other hand, just think about it this way. If you just doubled the supply of money out there, everything's going to get twice as expensive, right? If there's twice as much money, then everything's going to cost twice as much. If there's half as much money, everything's going to cost half as much, right? So if we just had a gold standard, all you'd have to do to save for retirement is just save your little gold coins, and they increase in value every year. The days like today when you say, you know, when I was a kid, a bottle of pop was only a dime or whatever. Remember, your parents told you that. My parents told me that. I've told people that, right? 120 years ago, little Johnny's dad was saying, when I was a kid, that bottle of pop cost twice as much, right? Things were falling in price in the 1800s up until the central bank, the Federal Reserve, got created and started ruining the money supply. So anyway, if the government really wanted to help the poor, just stop printing money. And then their money would actually not lose its value over time, and things wouldn't get more expensive all the time. That would help out the poor more than anything else. They could also eliminate licensing and things like that too. You know, all licensing does, you know, licensing is the government's excuse to keep people safe. You know, that's why hairdressers have to have a license. Because, I mean, my goodness, can you imagine if you went to a hair salon with an unlicensed hairstylist? I mean, you'd be decapitated, I guarantee it. I mean, you wouldn't survive the thing. I mean, your throat would be slit, blood running all over the place. It'd be a madhouse. I mean, I'm glad that there's government licensure out there.
Oh, they made those girls quit braiding hair at the festivals because they weren't. And they can braid hair beautifully, but they didn't have the certificate.
Oh yeah. I mean, just imagine what could happen to them though. I mean, you start braiding that hair and then somebody's neck gets snapped or something. I mean, you got to think about this kind of stuff, you know?
Yeah.
No, the real reason is because I'm sure some hairstylist got together at some point and lobbied some local or state government and said, you know what? It's really too dangerous to have people walking around with bad haircuts out there. We really need to get some regulation in this field, and we don't want charlatans in the business. You know, we want our people to look good, so we're going to have licensing. Now, what was that for? Was that for the betterment of society? No, it's because they want to keep other people out of the industry, right? That's what licensure is all about. So if the government got out of that, things would get a lot cheaper too. If any guy that had just done his homework and learned medicine could just practice medicine, and people could go to that guy to be their doctor if they wanted to, and he didn't have $250,000 of student loans to pay back, he might not have to charge $100 and some an hour or $200 and some an hour, right? Things would be a lot cheaper if you got rid of all this licensure stuff. And people that wanted to go to a guy that maybe had some credentials from some private organization, they could do so, you know? And somebody that didn't care about that, they could do their thing too. And anyway. Okay, just about done here. Charity should begin close to home. See, this is the thing. If you do it the Bible way, you're not going to have organizations helping people that they've never met somewhere in some faraway land. You're going to have individuals helping people that they know, and that they know what they're giving them, and they know that they're actually helping them. This is what the Bible teaches. Deuteronomy 15, 7 through 11. Deuteronomy 15, 7 through 11. It says, if there be a poor man of one of thy brethren within any of thy gates in thy land, which the Lord thy God giveth thee, thou shalt not harden thine heart, thou, or nor shut thine hand from thy poor brother, but thou shalt open thine hand wide unto him, and shalt surely lend him sufficient for his need in that which he wanteth. Now in the King James, want means need. You know, it doesn't mean your desire, but it means what you lack. So you see there, just from this, it's a poor man of thy brethren within thy gates in thy land, right? It's something local, and it's somebody that has need, and you were to lend him sufficient for his need, for his basic necessities. Beware that there be not a thought in thy wicked heart, saying, the seventh year, the year of release, is at hand, and thine eye be evil against thy poor brother, and thou givest him not, and he cry unto the Lord against thee, and it be sin unto thee. Thou shalt surely give him, and thine heart shall not be grieved when thou givest unto him, because that for this thing the Lord thy God shall bless thee in all thy works, and in all that thou puttest thine hand unto. You see, God says, if you help out your poor brother that's in need, the Lord will bless you and bless your work and take care of you. For the poor shall never cease out of the land. Therefore, I command thee, saying, thou shalt open thine hand wide unto thy brother, to thy poor, to thy needy in thy land. See, it's a local thing, and it's to need. You see, that's what the Bible teaches. Now, when it's done like this, when it's done locally by individuals, not by third parties or something, then money or things are given to those who can't work, not to those who won't work. You see, there's a difference. Paul said in 2 Thessalonians 3 and verse 10, that if any man shall not work, or any man will not work, neither shall he eat. 2 Thessalonians 3 and verse 10. He says, for even when we were with you, this we commanded you, that if any would not work, neither should he eat. It doesn't say if he cannot work, but if he would not, if he will not work, if he could but he won't. That's the case, he shouldn't get anything. If you're able-bodied and you can work but you won't, you don't get any charity from me. You shouldn't get any charity from anybody. Most of the people that are on welfare today can work. They just don't work. Now you also have these perverse incentives though, or disincentives, because the difference between, how do I put it? If you're on welfare and you're making enough to get by, and then you went and took a job that might actually pay less than your welfare, nobody's going to do that, right? Because you're going to be worse off. Or what if, let's say you're maybe the government's giving you $20,000 a year and that's just enough to get you by, and you could get a job where you're making $22,000 a year. Are you going to do it? Most people are. Well, I should say, there are a lot of people that wouldn't, right? There are some people like me that just said, you know, I don't care if I got to go at 3 jobs. I'm getting off this stuff, right, as soon as I can, and I'm going to take care of myself. But anyway, a lot of people, that gap, that $2,000 gap, it's like basically you're working for $2,000 if you think about it. Because if you could get the welfare, the 20 grand for free, and working you could get 22, you're really only making the 2,000, and you're thinking, I'm working all year long for $2,000? There's a perverse incentive there. If the welfare wasn't there, they'd take that job in a heartbeat, right? So that's why the government programs like that just disincentivize work to a horrible extent. Mm-hmm. Now, when charity is kept close to home, the wise man can then give with discretion because he has personal knowledge of the need. Psalm 112 and verse 5. This cannot be done when you're talking about government so-called charity, but in the private sector, it certainly can and should be. Psalm 112:5, a good man showeth favor and lendeth. He will guide his affairs with discretion. You see, showing favor and lending is tied to being discreet. So he's going to be wise, the good man that does lend to people and does show favor to people will do so with discretion. He's not going to willy-nilly just give out money to anybody that asks for it, right? He's not going to give to every bum that's got a cup out holding his hand out, right? He's going to, I mean, if I'm going to give to a bum, most of the time, if I was going to do that, I would say, hey, why are you sitting here? Why don't you have a job? Where do you live? You know, what? Try to find out something about the guy before I would help him out. Or get him food. I've done this before. One time, I've probably told this story before, but I was traveling down to Alabama one time. It was real late at night. We stopped somewhere, and this guy came up to the car and wanted to know if I could give him some money to get something at the Waffle House across the street. I said, well, I'll tell you what. I'll take you into the gas station. I'll get you something here. Oh, no, it's too expensive here, man. Well, I just want to go to the Waffle House. I'm thinking, well, I'm paying for it, so don't worry about it. You know, it was nice of him because he was afraid that I was going to spend too much money at the gas station. He was going to save me some money by going to the Waffle House. I have a feeling he was probably going to go to the bar or, you know, to the beer section or something. It was, so I said, well, it's up to you, man. I'll take you in here and get you a sandwich or nothing. Ah, no, don't worry about it. Okay. Well, then he comes back and says, you know what, I'll take you up on it. Okay, so we went in there and got him something. I forget what it was, but anyway, I don't think he was truly in need. You know, typically people that are starving to death aren't going to turn down a sandwich because they could get something cheaper at the Waffle House, you know, more than likely. But anyway, this, whenever you keep it close to home and you can guide your affairs with discretion, this is going to greatly reduce fraud. And this will help to ensure that charitable giving is a means to an end for the poor. It's not the end itself, right? Because giving to somebody should just be something to get them over the hump, right? Not to be their sufficiency for the rest of their lives, right? Because that's not going to help them out at all. We're never going to be able to end poverty entirely, but we can at least help to alleviate it in the lives with those whom we have contact with in our own families or in our own communities. So that's all that I have to say on the subject of inequality, and I thank you for your kind and patient attention. I know that there was some stuff in there that, you know, wasn't out of the Bible, and it was just my own thoughts and ramblings, and if you like that, you can take it. And if you don't like it, well, you don't have to take it. Then you just take the other stuff.